Welcome to this special podcast edition of From the Ruins of a Greenhouse. I am your host, Matthias Olsson from Campfire Stories. If you enjoy this work, like the films we produce that can be seen at campfire-stories.org, you might consider becoming a Patreon member. What that means is that you decide on a monthly amount that you don't mind parting ways with, say $2 or $5. It also probably means that you have to get your credit card out and spend a minute or so filling out a form, which I know can be pretty annoying. But on the other hand, you only have to do that one time. As a Patreon member, you get the inside track to new releases, and on some of the levels, you get to have your name in the credits of our films. Find out more at patreon.com/Matthias Olsson. That's patreon.com/MATTIASOLSSON. Look for a link in the show description. Now, let me set the scene for you. We're in Sweden, about an hour outside of the capital, Stockholm, at a beloved community garden project called Undertallarna, where some months ago the big centerpiece greenhouse had burned to the ground. We'd put up one of those festival tents over the ruins of the greenhouse. In one end of the space is a makeshift stage with a couch and an armchair. And in front of that, 100 chairs with 100 people sitting in them, attentively taking in what's unfolding and what's about to unfold. Right now, Petronella Sjö, who is the opening act for the evening, is playing the crystal bowls and singing. In a minute, I will enter the stage and invite Stephen Jenkinson to have a seat next to me for an interview with topics ranging from soil to soul. As you will soon become aware, Mr. Jenkinson wasn't overly thrilled with my somewhat casual introduction of him during the proceedings. I will make up for that now by introducing him formally here. After the introduction, let's listen in on Petronella's performance. And then, well, let the show begin. Stephen Jenkinson is a culture activist, a farmer and an author. He's the creator and principal instructor of the Orphan Wisdom School, co-founded with his wife, Natalie Roy. He has a master's degree in theology from Harvard University and another one in social work from the University of Toronto. Apprenticed to a master storyteller when he was a young man, he has since worked extensively with dying people and their families. He's a former program director at a major Canadian hospital and a former assistant professor in a prominent Canadian medical school. He's also a sculptor and a traditional canoe builder. Mr. Jenkinson is the author of several books, including Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, the award-winning book about grief and dying and the great love of life. This was followed by Come of Age, The Case for Elderhood in a Time of Trouble. Since co-founding the Knights of Grief and Mystery Project with singer-songwriter Gregory Hoskins, he's toured with this musical-slash-tent-show-revival-slash-ceremony of a show across North America, the United Kingdom, Scandinavia, Australia, and beyond. In the recording you're about to hear, Jenkinson and Hoskins had performed one of those Nights of Grief and Mystery shows just the evening before, in Malmö, in the south of Sweden, and were on their way to performing it again the next day at the Sigtuna Foundation, as they moved on through the Scandinavian leg of the world tour. I was, and I am, extremely fortunate that with such a packed schedule, they were still able to find the time to come meet me in a tent in the middle of nowhere for this event. From the ruins of a greenhouse. Enjoy the show.
Ooh. ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce to you Stephen Jenkinson. No. Welcome to this place called Undertalarna.
Thank you so much.
And welcome to Sweden.
Thank you. And I should say right out of the gate how kind you are to allow me to speak in Canadian for the whole evening. It's the only language I have. You're learning Canadian at school, apparently. Is it true? Okay, good. We'll be fine then.
All right, so this place where we are right now, this used to be a greenhouse, obviously. The title of this evening is From the Ruins of a Greenhouse. This place used to be a place of agriculture, of food making, food giving out food to the locals, food production, and also a place of celebration and gathering. And I hope it will be all of those things again soon. We hope that we are playing a small part in the rebirth of this place. I don't know, but hopefully. But I'd like to begin, because rumor has it that you're a farming man yourself, and I'd like to begin by drawing a comparison between this place and your farm, and maybe your connection with soil.
Oh, you'd like me to do that?
I can do it, but I don't think it'll be as good.
That was a very Swedish thing to do, what he just did there. It's kind of, I was ready for a long description of me. And now I have to describe me.
You once told me that you got a glowing introduction by somebody.
Yeah.
Giving all of your achievements.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had to dig yourself out of that hole of all the expectations.
Yeah.
So I'm doing the opposite.
This is extreme in the other direction, though. This is, I have to climb down from the heights of self-aggrandizement now.
Sorry, and you're welcome.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's enough chatter. Let's see. I was sitting up in the hill watching all of you come in. And I was thinking to myself, this is not why I went to divinity school, to do an evening like this. So fortunately, I've outgrown my original reasons for the vocation I had in mind for myself. I didn't really know what they were at the time. And I was desperate to get into the priesthood of something. I mean, that's how clear I was about it. But the priesthood wouldn't have me. There was a detail that emerged when they were vetting me. Do you know the word to vet? Yeah. And the detail was that I'd never been to church. I didn't think this was a big obstacle. I mean, a lot of people go to church. It doesn't seem to help them. So I thought, maybe I'll try another angle. Never having gone to church, I have absolutely nothing to outgrow. But I was the only one who thought this. And they wouldn't have me. And some time did go by, but I suspect everything that I would have put into the priesthood, some kind of priesthood, turned into farming. I think that's literally what happened to it. Secondarily, I ended up in the death trade. And I was in the death trade first, but I realize now that what I was doing was losing all of my old reasons for almost everything. That's what was disappearing. And I guess I deeply recommend the notion that is this a good sound, by the way? Yeah. Am I close enough? The thing I'd recommend early on in this discussion is the notion that farming should not be a consequence of your beliefs. It should be a consequence of the undoing of your beliefs, mostly. Because generally speaking, most people's beliefs don't come from the land. I mean, we're not living in such a time. Most of us in the Western world are not living in a time where most of our convictions are land-based convictions. even our convictions about the land don't really come from time in with the land. They come in, they come from a distance from the land and a desire to close the distance. Yeah. Which, of course, is our idea. It's not so clear that it's the land's idea, though. So when we're farming at home, which I've been doing for 20, almost 5 years now, so that's a good beginning in farming. One of the things we do routinely is remind each other to not preoccupy ourselves with the busyness that farming can easily generate in you. You can literally go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing all day long, all night long, all week long, and there's no weeks, there's no months, there's no years. There's no holidays or holy days or anything in between. And so we routinely stop and lean on the fence. We have to assume this certain position, right? You can't just do it. You have to pantomime a rest. And then we proceed to what we call watch the farm channel. It's a modern allegory. But the notion, of course, is that farming is not mostly doing. Farming is mostly watching the consequences of what you already did, what you've already done. Not just you personally, but everything that happened to that land before you happened to that land. And depending on where you're trying to do the work, this can be some very grim things indeed that preceded you there. My own farm was a drug addict when I met it. Absolutely a drug addict. We just had the shakes. Terrible quality of soil. And was obliged year after year to artificially produce a chemically derived stuff. And so the first thing I had to do was give the land some kind of absolution from no further obligation to be productive ever again. Never mind that year. Never again will I oblige you to produce in that way or in any way that could be remind you of that. And I think, and the other thing we did, literally in the first week we were there, I think, is we decided where the four corners of the farm were, which was kind of arbitrary because it's a funny shape. But we designated four corners to be the stand-in for the four corners on the compass, which is a geomantic. Do you know this word? Geomancy? Somebody can translate into Swedish?
Geomancy. It's the same
word. It's the same word. I thought it would be. Sure.
Still don't know.
Yeah, we'll leave that as a slight mystery for the proceedings. Yeah? Okay, good. That's what it is. We went to the four corners and we made vows, which is a much different word than promise. Promise is what you're going to do in the future. Vow is what you're doing now by virtue of saying it. You're incarnating your declaration. So we went to the four places and we left extremely precious things to us personally, but also in the marketplace this way. Under those four places. So someday somebody will find them and think, well, this lazy farmer's just stuff fell out of their pocket and they didn't go looking for it. No, it's there deliberately. We did that. The four corners have made the vows about how we proceed, we intended to proceed. And the other thing we did was designate a corner of the farm that we would never go to. And in 25 years, we never have. So I have no idea what's going on there. None. I still allegedly own the place, but that's a corridor of a little piece of the wilderness reverted to itself with no intrusion, no landscaping, nothing, no presence, no nothing, no apologies, no nothing. Just stay away so they don't have to smell you, so they can feel that maybe this is one way to get to the river in the way that they used to, because that's the corridor from the mountain to the river. So some place of the thing I'm responsible for remains mysterious to me. I don't know everything that's got my name on it, and I know less and less the longer I'm there. And that's a good recommendation, to be overwhelmed in terms of your initial intentions, and to begin to receive instruction from a place that you have to learn its language before you learn what it says. It's very hard to do that when you hear your own language running and running and running, and your own vows and your own fears and your own efforts to try to overcome the city in you and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Thank you very much. This is what happens. I open with a question, and then it's like, oh, we could talk about this for an hour or two.
Yeah.
But then I have like 10 other questions
here,
so we'll see. We'll, I guess I'll drive the bus and we'll see where it goes.
Sure.
Yeah. So you've been called a spiritual activist by some, probably myself included. And in order for the word activist to make sense, there needs to be on the one side a willingness to work or to like to have a method of working. And on the other side, there needs to be something that you object to, something that is an issue, a problem, a poverty of some kind.
Do I get to challenge this assumption?
Soon.
Okay.
Very soon.
Okay.
I'd like to set the tone here tonight by establishing what it is that you think is wrong in society. And by when I say the word society, I mean any culture you'd look at as being modern. So any culture where you can say the word McDonald's and most people know what you're talking about, that type of place. What are some of the, in your words, poverties of our times?
Perhaps the principal poverty is globalization. It might be the principal evil, too. That's a very strong word. I don't use this word ever, really. But I think it's accurate to describe the notion that the differences between us have to be overcome in order for us to be useful in this world. The differences between us look to me to be given by the makers of life. And so they belong here. The differences between us have become problems as a consequence of some other thing, not as a consequence of the differences. We, you know, sorry for offending if the following sentence offends. But the one God religions have a lot to answer for. Not to me, maybe not to you, but someday they're going to have to stand alongside what they put into motion. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of readiness or willingness to do that. So the one God religions were a preamble, excuse me, for the crypto-globalization of the human heart that is underway. That's a mouthful now. Crypto meaning secretive globalization of the human heart, where we're all basically obliged to be mutually recognizable and mutually intelligible like that, instantly. So I think most of the contemporary poverties ensue from the inability to believe in the fundament, which is diversity. Here's a caveat, though. You and I both know that the word diversity has a lot of psychological and political coinage around it now. I'm not saying that the alternative to the dilemma that I just described is that all the diversity in the world is everywhere in the world. I didn't say that. And that's not what I mean. In fact, that's the globalization I'm referring to. Certain diversities belong in certain places. And the notion that they have to be evenly distributed across the globe for us to have a just society, or a combination of just societies, I should say, is part of the poverty speaking. That's a dream about justice that is never awoken. That's what that is to me. Obviously, we could say a lot more things, no, but I'm mindful that that the night is waiting.
In your work, there are two phrases that keep coming back and that I think are central to what you are working for. And one of them is village-mindedness, and the other one is having an animistic understanding of the world. What do those two mean to you and to your work?
Well, I coined the term village-mindedness as an alternative to the word village. I found, for example, the word community is used so frequently that the mind just gets tired at the sound of the word. You know what I mean? It's just like I don't care about it anymore. It's a terrible thing to say out loud, but I just don't. It's just not a well-achieved word any longer. It's just been too... Anyway, you get the idea. So I thought, can we do better than community? Well, the answer is we have to. I don't know if we can, but we must. So how to do so? One of the ways is attend to your language. And I don't literally mean the national boundaries of your particular language or the geopolitical realities that it comes from. I mean the kind of the rational, but also the emotive, the invocation power of the various languages that are on the planet. That's what you have to take care of. Because if you don't, then the people who are trying to sell you things you don't need will do it for you and are doing it for you. Right? And every time you check in with your messages, they have a little more information about what you're most anxious about and what you're most afraid of. And of course, you know that's what's being sold to you. And that's the way it's being sold at the same time. So village-mindedness is a kind of, is my attempt to distinguish a living arrangement from a kind of, another kind of repetitive word, consciousness. A kind of, a living arrangement is sometimes you can manage it, and a lot of times you can't. Sometimes the politics or the finances don't permit it. You may have had this experience in trying to make things happen here, and where people actually are trying to live together. Intentional communities are... Well, try it. You know, I'll say that. Try it.
It seems like some of the audience members have.
Yeah. Yeah, or they're relieved that they haven't, maybe. No, intentional communities reflect what? Not the realities of community life. Intentional communities reflect intention, which is, generally speaking, not tried until you're actually in the mess now. And you've signed, and the money's changed hands, and, you know, all the stuff's going on. And people have come to me fairly routinely now and begun to ask questions about the intergenerational transmission of this village-minded work from the people who started it as they begin to dwindle and fail and die, how the young people are supposed to undertake something that they didn't begin. Yeah, so this is, it's known in the trade as succession. The successions are extremely difficult to manage. So anyway, I use the word village-mindedness to distinguish a condition of understanding from a living arrangement that may or may not carry that understanding. Yeah. What was the other one, sorry?
Animistic understanding
of the
world. Oh,
yes, yeah, animism. Well, this was brought into sharp relief for me years ago when I was lucky enough to travel briefly with Natalie in Mali, in West Africa. And I saw a pamphlet that the government produced. And it broke down the population of Mali according to their religious affiliation. And these were the designations that were used in the chart. There are only three of them. Muslim, I'm going to make up the numbers because I don't remember right now, but something like 92 or 93%. Christian, 4 or 5%. And the last one was animist. Now, if you're going to acknowledge in your census that a certain portion of your population is animist in their daily lives, then I think you have to acknowledge a likelihood that pertains to the other 97%. and change the designation and or at least allow a proper designation to come in. And that would be inanimists, would constitute 97-odd% of the population of the country. Inanimism is a fact. If animism is a fact, inanimism is a fact too. And that's a very jarring thought to think, I think. Is this sort of translating what I'm saying?
It's a negation of animism.
Yeah. In other words, if animism can be generally described as a willingness to acknowledge the fundamental aliveness of everything around you, not just everything with eyelashes and a heartbeat, everything around you, if that's what it is, then the unwillingness or the failure to do so needs a name, is what I'm saying. Animism these days is an immense achievement, very much against the grain, against the current of the times, where we reserve the acknowledgement of a soul or an aliveness for certain things that would benefit us to do so. But it seems to me that we would benefit much more if we acknowledged the utter aliveness of the world, of which we are a small and relatively insignificant part. Excuse me a sec. On that last point, I would say, here's something worth considering. Humans would appear to be the least needed species on the planet. That's the way it appears to me. I watch the scheme of necessity that seems to bind the world together. So I'm saying a lot of poetic terms on top of each other. Well, sue me. I can't not do it. This is what animism sounds like, I suppose. At least it does tonight. So you imagine that human beings seem to be the least required species on the planet. What do I mean? I mean, I can't think of a life form that needs us in order for it to be here. And then ask yourself whether that lack of necessity is reciprocal. In other words, do we not need most, if not all, of the other life forms in order to be our pristine and fabulous selves? And I'm suggesting to you quite the contrary. Human beings need every other life form in the world to be working for us to have any chance at all of making it through till tomorrow. And so we are the most dependent and the least necessary. And that seems to me to be a good recipe for a modern animism. Sounds like a speech. And please vote for me in the next election.
Well, this actually ties in nicely to the next word. That there's another word that you've used a lot when I've interviewed you in the past. And when I've asked about, well, what can we do? How can we begin to imagine a better day and so forth? And the word is misanthropy, which the first time you used it, I went along, and then afterwards I went and checked the dictionary just to be sure. And this is what my dictionary says. Hatred, dislike, or distrust of humankind. Would you like to elaborate a little bit? Now you just sort of put down humanity and said everything else is needed but humanity not, but maybe... Well, I'll leave it there. Dot, dot, dot. Go on.
Yeah, Matthias, I don't think this is a put-down at all. I think what it does is redistributes the insane concentration of self-importance that is gathered around humans. That's all it does. If it troubles you, you should investigate how easily troubled you are. Really, it takes the heat off of you to think the thought that I just said. You're not that necessary. You know, aw. That's not really the adult response to that. The adult response is, oh, thank God. I mean, everything doesn't depend on me. No, but, I mean, we have to distribute that understanding across the countryside for the relief to begin to happen. See, until then, we're going to have this current madness called personal truth. But there's nothing personal about the truth. The truth doesn't need us. But we could use true things. So I don't think it's misanthropic, what I said. I think quite the contrary, it's an antidote to misanthropy. To misanthropy. By which I mean this. Misanthropy is mistaken today. Oh, sorry, one sentence before. So we in the West pride ourselves on having a certain degree of historical alertness. Is that fair to say? A certain degree of historical awareness that is creeping into the curriculum at school very slowly. And some of it's deeply inconvenient, isn't it? Deeply inconvenient to those of us who, in this generation at least, are on top of the food chain. And as a result of the growing antipathy that humans have for their own ancestral histories, not all, but certainly all the modernist cultures do have this problem, yes, then we have begun to mistake having a conscience with having self-hatred. And until that distinction is very clearly made, you're going to have a lot of extremely wounded young people coming out of the educational system, internalizing personal responsibility for things they're not personally responsible for and cannot personally fix. And so it's exceedingly grim now to mistake conscience and historical awareness for personal culpability that results in a kind of generic dismissal of the possibilities that continue to reside in the human soul. Continue to reside. Hiding there in plain view. How's this going? Okay?
I think so.
Okay.
How are you feeling? You need anything?
Always.
Another beer?
No. I could tell you this, though, apropos of being introduced. Years ago, I was in Toronto being introduced for the umpteenth time. And rarely do I recognize myself in the interviews. My mother, excuse me, in the
Introductions,
thank you. My mother would recognize me even less. She doesn't know who they're talking about. I mean, if she were still alive, she'd say, who are they talking about to? I'd say, they think they're talking about me. He said, well, get them to stop, she would say. Sounds very bold. She would say things like this. So at one point, I was introduced in the following fashion. He's a visionary, they said. Now, of course, this is very well intended, and I take it as a compliment. But, as you said about digging out of the hole, if I'm sitting in front of people who look like me, like this, and I'm introduced as a visionary, you know it's not going to go well for the rest of the night. So anyway, I heard this, and I knew I had to do something before we started. So I got up in front of the room and I said, thank you for the introduction. Very kind and very kindly intended as well. However, there's one word there that sticks in me a little bit just because I think it's probably inaccurate in hue. What's the word for hue in Swedish?
Nyans.
Thank you. There we go.
Nyans.
Yeah.
Tack.
Is that nuance? Is it the same word? It's nuance. Okay, very good. Ah, we've met.
Learning stuff here.
Yeah. So I said, it's this word visionary now. I'm not sure. I'm not sure this is accurate. But I could get more accurate with a change of the word. I think it's more accurate to describe me as a divisionary. And as soon as I said it, I thought, wow, that's very... I wish I had a T-shirt that said that. Like, you know, the guys at the airport have one that says security. I would have one that says divisionary. I'd be the only one. But I think it's an important job to occupy for a while. Not that you become this full-time all the time, But for a while at least, you can... It's like playing Vegas here. You could work... You could understand that part of your life's work involves challenging the easy affinities that grow in hard times. I'll say that again. One of your life's work for a brief period of time, or fitfully, could be the opportunity to challenge the easy affinities, the easy high-five business, where we get over what we know to be there lurking between us and among us and inside us, and imagine that we're all doing the best we can and we're all on the same side, kind of thing. So divisionary work is honorable work, but it's not destructive, right? It's discerning. And there's a big difference.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Welcome.
Let's get the stage ready for you and Gregory.
Okay, are we on? Yeah? So a little background or foreground or some kind of ground to this holy ground, there we are, for this story goes something like this. True story, by the way. Really happened to. We kind of thought maybe we should try straight up collaborating on songs, which we've never done before because I left Gregory to his stuff, you know, properly, respectfully so. And I took care of my end of things and we crossed over and over again. But this time, we thought, and the same week we decided to do it, I get a phone call from a man I don't know in Malibu, California. And this man happens to own a boutique recording studio in Malibu, California. And it was the only building for miles around that survived the fires that raged through there about three, four years ago. And all the bigs have recorded there, or so I was led to understand. Oh, they truly have. The reason I know this is because on the back end of our recording there, which we did go for 5 days, the man who owned the joint said, "Now you got to sign the piano like everybody who's been here before you does." I said, "Come on now, I'm not in that league." And he said, "I'll be the judge of that." That's literally what he said. He brought me over to the piano and he opened it up, and on the inside where all that metal is, all these signatures, man, you wouldn't have known three quarters of them. I didn't know them all. But I knew the bigs when I recognized it. And big people sign big. Just in case you're planning on being big later in life, make sure your signature's like ridiculous. So there's Cher, right? Bono, right? I don't know what, Coldplay guy, Chris Martin, whatever. It just went on and freaking on Barbra Streisand, just to be intergenerational about the whole thing. And I'm thinking to myself, me? I'm going to go in there too? All right, man, if you say so. He was adamant. He had me a Sharpie pen, and he was ready to film the whole event. And I'm looking for a place to play, and I can't find one. These guys have all got their big signatures everywhere. And then he lifted off the music stand that was right in front there. And there was an acreage that nobody had plowed, or almost nobody. There was one signature. And I said, right then, I'm signing right beside Nick Cave. So me and Nick Cave are side by each. If you meet him, don't tell him that shit. He doesn't need that burden in life. But I don't mind knowing it. But how did all this come to pass? I mean, we had two records at the time. Three. We had three records at the time. But this man said something to me very disarming. I said, "We don't know each other, do we?" He said, "No." I said, "What? Please help me understand why you think offering me your studio is a good idea." He said, "Oh, I don't know you from nothing. I don't know anything about your work. I don't have a feeling about it one way or the other. But," he said, "my wife loves you. So as long as you stay on the right side of that line, that can work out for you." That's the first half. Here's the other half. Sometimes things float around. It's not you're walking around saying, "Yeah, next record, I'm going to get that in there." I mean, I never think that way. But still, these things stay with you like little pieces of adamants, like little signs that you didn't quite ask for, but you're the caretaker of now. And both of them came from young people. Little observations they made, or the collapse of observation they made. Maybe that's what it was. Remember that young woman who said, "I'm afraid to live"? These two young people found a way of saying something similar. And we heard it and we decided, oh man, it's a love song time. And so we made a love song from these two little things and from this great chance. And from some man's wife's fondness for me. And we call it "The Hearts Like the World." The autumn of the year, and we're at the southern edge of the northern hemisphere. Oh, and it's dusk's version of daylight, and we're smudged in mesquite, and it's a dozen young people, and it's me. A generation ahead of them or a generation behind, it's kind of hard to tell, and nobody knows how to have age in their midst, not anymore. So they're checking their messages, you see. And they're chafing under the hair shirt of privilege and of race and all the rest. And so they're brailing their gadgetry for signs of grace and the rest. And there's not a trace. There's just more ways to say it. And they're inventing things to say. Second best. And I'm a stranger. And I'm exotic for a while. And I'm temporary. And I'm a writing guy. And I'm an old man, and we're alone together. And one woman asked me, "So what are you working on?" "Oh, something about matrimony," I say. "But why?" she says. "That shit's just done. And there's no shelter from the storm, not in that certainty. And for every friend that goes downtown to go up the aisle, there's 20 who stay home and partner up and play house. Make do. And I'm twice married. And so I say, you know, I want to get the details down before the whole thing's just gone." And suddenly she gives me the deepest sorrowing look and she says, "I want to read that book. That might be as close as I ever come."
Love's not there to mistreat you, beat you or cheat you. The creator that fits in the palm of your hand is there to unseat you and in a hard way complete you. The creator companion just beyond your command.
And so you have two daughters and you have a son, and they're watching. And they gather around what's missing in you, and what's gone from you, and what's left of the music that's there in you. And they're perched on the cliffside, and they're wrecked by the roadside. And so they're watching for signs of life left in you. Oh, the heart's like the world now. It's not what it was. You ask them why. It's just because. And they're single now. And they're singled out. And they've made their lover's vows. Safety first. And then me. And then you. But love? There's no safety there. There's just one truth. And then there's another. And then there's so many things to do. "So what are you working on?" they say. "Oh, something about love," you say. "But why?" they say. "That shit's just done." And you're twice across the threshold. and there's irony in the house, and you say, oh, I want to get the details right. They're just not that hard to forget. Oh, love's like God now, they say. It's dead. Takes you by the hand.
Is there to unseat you in a hard way complete?
Flesh is torn, make me useful in a war. Take my fear and give it edges. Make me dance out on the ledge.
forbidding. It's been this way since the beginning. Now my hair is gray and thinning. Do you need me anymore? Oh, make me useful. You don't gotta tell me what side I'm fighting for. Side I'm fighting for. No, you don't gotta tell me. What side? You don't gotta tell me what side, what side, what side. Don't tell me what side.
This was episode 1 of 2 of the special podcast edition of From the Ruins of a Greenhouse. A deep thank you to all of the Patreon supporters who make it possible for me to keep doing this work. Thank you Suki Cannon, Lisette Toft, Brigitte Reppen, September Larsson, Livsring vid Silje Hystad, Camelia Freiberg, Alice Hall, Peggy Campbell, Nicole Alger, and all the rest of you. Without your contributions, Campfire Stories simply wouldn't exist. To find out more about becoming a Patreon supporter, please visit patreon.com/MattiasOlsson. PATREON.com/MATTIASOLSSON. Thank you so much, and until the next time.